go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go. Just like John Fox says, a minute and a half past the hour on this, the 25th day of February, 2016. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live, and that's where you go to jump into the chat room and become part of the madcap multimedia real-time extravaganza that is Horn Chat. Good evening to King of Cups, Labor Man, Little Gray, Texas Tea. There's Jug of Punch just now entering the room. More folks will be along presently, including you, if you so desire. Just pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and you can be part of the whole fracas, all capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who is there and just keeping a gentle hand on order in the place. This is, of course, a listener-supported radio operation of 10 years duration, more than, actually. And, there's a contribute tab at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. I'm really, really excited and tickled pleased to begin the program this evening, because we've got a conversation and a gentleman is on the line right now. I'll be bringing him on in a moment just after the basics of the introduction. Carol Baker alerted me to the existence of a post the other day by Anthony Conright. And it was called, What the Bernie Sanders... I'm Bob Kincaid. What the Bernie Sanders unelectable argument says about black lives. And it can be found at blackandwordy.com, just like it sounds, W-O-R-D-Y, blackandwordy.com. Anthony Conright himself is an amazing young man. I say young man because, you know, I'm a guy in his mid-50s. Started writing after a junior year of high school assignment to keep to create a 30-page journal during the summer. That was a few years back, and he started writing, and well, since then he hasn't stopped. He has pursued a formidable education, holding degrees in interdisciplinary studies and degreed in math, English, and history. Yeah, formidable indeed. Right now, he joins us via Skype from India, where he has taken his talents to try to make people's lives better. Good evening, Anthony. It is a real pleasure to meet you.
Oh, thank you for having me, Bob.
Obviously, your post about unelectability. That started the conversation, but the more I read, the more fascinated I become. And I hope, heaven only knows where this conversation will take us. We are not, we're not orthodox around here, and we're not necessarily bound to particular topicalities, but I think that is a good place to start. Let me simply ask you, what was the jumping off place for you that inspired you to write, or address this unelectability aspect that's all over the place in the for-profit media these days?
Well, it all started when Hillary Clinton launched her presidential campaign. And from there, everyone kind of shooed her in. And I said, well, that doesn't sound like democracy to me. And when a campaign that starts with I'm ready for Hillary kind of bothered me. And I thought, well, what if I'm not ready for Hillary? And she should be ready for me. And it didn't feel like she was. And I said, well, if I didn't vote for her in 2008, why would I automatically be ready for her now? And I posted a Facebook post and I said, this is odd. I would much rather have Bernie Sanders as a presidential nominee or as president. And so as the campaign kind of went on and I listened to pundits talk about who's electable and everything, it was, even though Bernie Sanders is an old white man, I was reminded of the 2008 campaign when people said the same thing about Barack Obama. I mean, the very similar things. And I thought to myself, well, when people said, well, Barack Obama is unelectable, a lot of people in the media said, well, it's sort of racist. It's implying that he's unelectable because he's black. And I thought to myself, well, just because Bernie Sanders is white and is running on a platform that helps black people, the same thing can be said. So it's not so much about the color of the skin, even though obviously in Barack Obama's case it was. It's also about the color of the policies, so to speak. And so for me, when people said, well, a person who wants to give health care to everyone is unelectable, a person who wants to go after private prisons is unelectable, a person who wants to make college public universities tuition free is unelectable, I just thought to myself, I was like, that's a little odd. Like, isn't that what we should be striving for? Even if let's say they're promises right now. But if you think about negotiating and what has made people frustrated about Barack Obama, it's where you start the conversation. And I'm willing to put my money on the person who's willing to start the conversation from the place of, well, we want to decriminalize marijuana so we stop disproportionately jailing black Americans. And so when he announced his platform, they said, oh, well, that's unelectable. It's like, ah, no, what you're really saying is the people whose policies would support are politically unviable. And when you say that, what you're really saying is, well, these people don't matter because these people don't give us money. These people don't fund our campaigns. We have these huge PACs and we can receive unlimited money from very wealthy people. And as most people know, when you look at who owns wealth, it's not the marginalized in society. And so that's kind of where it started for me. I just thought it was so weird that, you know, we wanted Barack Obama to champion for universal health care and the public option, and then now that Bernie Sanders is, people are saying, oh, well, that's unelectable. And it just rubbed me the wrong way.
I think it rubs a lot of us along the way, the wrong way, Anthony. Within your critique, is there not also a certain kernel of truth that the word unelectable is a word that is deployed by a certain class, a political class, perhaps we would call them the 1%, who predetermine for the rest of us what constitutes electability?
Well, I think the phrase is ironic. When I first started writing it, I said, well, you can't be unelectable, right? You can't. The point of democracy is that anyone is electable. And so I thought that it was a phrase that just didn't make sense. I was going to go with inelectable. But I think to a certain degree, you're absolutely right. I mean, if we have a situation where candidates are, I think Jeb Bush I saw $150 million he spent on his campaign.
Yeah.
And it's where do you get that kind of money? I mean, Bernie Sanders, I know he said he's raising $27 a pop. And that And that tells you something about what, you're right, that tells you something about what does make someone electable or unelectable. And it's in the concept of spending $150 million to participate in democracy, I think tells you something about the state.
It kind of tells you that that's a very special, narrow definition of democracy, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
That's democracy that you and I are not going to be participating in anytime soon.
Exactly. I don't know how I would raise $150 million.
Hey, but our best hope then becomes one of you of having as a surrogate someone who objects to that system. Mm-hmm. And who is willing to forego aspects of that system, the PAC system, mm-hmm. for instance, mm-hmm. And to use our power $1 at a time, $5 at a time,
exactly,
to try to manifest some level of democratic participation. Now, all of this, I mean, from the name of your word site, or from the name of your website, Black and Wordy. Mm-hmm. To the name of the post, the title of the post, what Unelectable says about Black Lives, you have wrapped the concept and the issue within that demographic, if you will, within mm-hmm. within that identification. Mm-hmm. Where then is there a particularized message? Because, you know, ever since New Hampshire got over with. Mm-hmm. The people who know better than we have said, well, you know, I mean, in New Hampshire and Iowa, and I want to be careful that I personally, Anthony, don't ever want to come off sounding like one of Richard Pryor's impressions of white people. I don't know if you've ever heard it. But the pundit class doesn't seem to mind. And so mm-hmm. after Iowa and after New Hampshire, we got, oh, well, you know, those were just a bunch of cranky old white people. Hillary will mm-hmm. certainly show Bernie up when she goes to South Carolina, because she can. And this is where, you know, because I was Southern born and I'm born and raised in Alabama. I live in Appalachia. So I know where I am and I know what the mm-hmm. dynamics are. And when I hear that, I kind of get a little sort of sidewaysy and icky feeling, because I just hear an undercurrent there that's, how dare anybody say that Hillary Clinton controls anything or anyone? I mean, if the vote actually matters.
Yeah, I actually wrote something, a piece called Black Progressives, It's Time to Unite Against Establishment Politics. And it actually addresses this issue of me being a part of Hillary Clinton's supposed firewall, and it addresses the idea that she sort of has Black voters in her back pocket via Bill Clinton, and that entire narrative really, really bothered me.
All the way down to. And of course, you were considerably younger at the time, but, you know, back when they declared, and I forget who was it was an author who declared Bill Clinton to be our first Black president. And even back then, I was going,
Toni Morrison.
Yeah, Toni Morrison. I was going, oh, well, that's uncomfortable. You know, not because yeah. I was offended by the idea, but, you know, I didn't know that one could be honorarily. Oh, well, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, well, here's how she meant that. She meant it in a sense. She meant it to as if to say he's already guilty. So she was saying that. So it wasn't a compliment. I think it may have been taken the wrong way when it was originally reported. But she meant it to say that he's the first Black president, in the sense that when you are a Black person in America, you sort of presume this. You assume guilt, if that makes sense. So before he's done anything, he's already guilty, and you can kind of see that in the Barack Obama campaign. So Barack Obama is elected, and Mitch McConnell says, "Well, we're just going to block everything that he wants to do," and it's that sort of
Well, no one had ever said, I mean, granted, the Republican opposition to Bill Clinton was fierce, but no one ever said anything in exactly those terms about any previous president. So it's kind of hard to look at that response and say, well, you know, what's the difference? And not come out with a very obvious answer.
Well, what I think one could say is that it would be more fitting to call Bernie Sanders our second black president, because he's actually presumed to be guilty before he's even in office already. So he's faced the sort of attacks that Martin Luther King Jr. has actually faced. So. He's a communist. He's a socialist. Those are the same things that people said about Martin Luther King Jr. And by the way, unfortunately, black people have forgotten that Bernie Sanders is actually advocating for a lot of the same things Martin Luther King Jr. advocated for. However, that version of Martin Luther King Jr. is a version that no one really talks about, because Martin Luther King Jr. explicitly challenges capitalism. And there's been reports of him even referring to the fact that one of the possible answers is democratic socialism. But because a lot of our black politicians are part of the establishment, they don't talk about that. And so when Hillary Clinton starts her campaign in the South for black voters, and when the CVC PACT endorsed her, they didn't tell black voters or American voters about Bernie Sanders' history with civil rights. They didn't talk about the fact that Martin Luther King Jr. advocated for very similar policies in even a very similar way as Bernie Sanders. You know, and I think it's unfortunate. I actually would go on to even say that it's insulting, and I think it shows that even black Americans and black politicians can sort of sing along to the same anthems of white supremacy that a white person can, or any person who's a part of the establishment.
Or that it can be quickly modified by access to power. I found a certain degree of irony. A couple of nights ago on the program, we were talking about Ben Carson's recent remark that, you know, Barack Obama, for all he's been through, isn't really black, that he doesn't understand the black experience, that somehow he, Ben Carson, has the authentic black experience. And again, that's very off-putting as well. But lo and behold, no sooner do I get done with that story than I go over and I read a story on the New York Times declaring that Bernie Sanders isn't Jewish enough. in which there was even a quote from some guy who said, well, you know, when Joe Lieberman, he was a very observant Jew, and you know, when he got nominated to be VP, it was a much bigger deal. And, I spend a lot of time around here, Anthony, just, you know, with my head just kind of rebounding off the desk going, whack, you know, and that was, it's so... Apparently, within the establishment attack machine, which has been very, very carefully put together, probably with the help of some political campaigns, the narrative seems to be set up such that, you know, Bernie Sanders is damned if he doesn't, damned if he doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and it tells you something. So, for example, Let's say whoever's listening to this can actually test this and see if it's true. Now, it's one thing to say, for Bernie Sanders to say, you know what? Everyone should have health care. And here's my proposal for doing it. Now, let's say an economist says, you know what? That plan's not going to work. Don't vote for him. Now, that's very different than saying, you know what? Universal healthcare is a good idea, and the proposal you have may not work, but here's what we can do to actually get there. You know what? Maybe your proposal for having college tuition free, that may not work, but here's what we could do. You will not find that anywhere. You will not find it anywhere. And of course, it is the responsibility of the candidate to articulate their platform and their proposals. But I think there's something, I think that's different than someone saying, well, this particular proposal just won't work, so therefore we just shouldn't vote for him. And that narrative is so strong in the mainstream media. And I've actually, I was actually talking to Carol last night about the way in which the media controls not only a candidate's popularity, but the way in which readers interpret information. And it just so I wish I could show everyone my search history, at least up until yesterday, because I was comparing the way the media has covered Donald Trump David Duke's presidential campaign. And I wake up this morning and guess what? David Duke endorses Donald Trump.
Well, of course he did.
Oh my God, you can't make this up. But anyone who's savvy to the way in which the media reports topics and people could see it coming a mile away. You know, the media, a lot of the media says, well, the Republican Party, the narrative that the media controls would say is something like, well, the Republican Party created Donald Trump. And it's not really, or at least not completely. The media helped control Donald Trump. And I was just working on a piece that says, well, if we really, really wanted to do something about Donald Trump, the media would have never reported on the stupid things that he says. And I would even go as far as to say, why do we care that David Duke has endorsed Donald Trump? Like, why do I care about that? I mean, it's dangerous, yeah, but it's not surprising that a white supremacist would support Donald Trump. And to be honest, like, the only people who really care about that, the only people that endorsement matters to, are other white supremacists and bigots. And when the media reports on these things the way they do, it actually does more harm to folks like me than it does to help. And so I think the way, unfortunately, the way the media has reported on a lot of the Bernie Sanders topics, events, and have controlled the narrative have been unfortunate.
Less than helpful. Yes.
Yeah.
But that's and that's to say, to the extent that they've reported upon it at all.
Exactly.
Well, then let's move over, if it's okay, Anthony, to the issue of your generation. This is the first time we've ever talked. I don't expect you to have much personal knowledge about where I'm coming from, but I am at the tail end of the baby boom.
Okay.
I've got a sister who is at the front end and I'm at the back end. I was born in 1963. And I freely acknowledge how much my generation has gotten wrong. To a certain extent, you know, my generation helped hand the White House to George W. Bush.
Well,
yeah, my generation was just beginning to vote, my age group was just beginning to vote when, to the extent that we bothered to go and vote, and a bunch of us went and voted for Ronald Reagan's second term in office. Mm-hmm. Yay us! But there's a lot of dismissal. And maybe that's habitual from generation unto generation, but there's a lot of dismissal of your generation as a voting force. Do you think it's different this time? Because I hope to goodness it is.
Yes. Well, what you're dealing with when you're looking at generational differences, you have to put that generation into a social context, for example. And unfortunately, it's rare that you find people who are literally ahead of their time in the sense that, let's take a Martin Luther King Jr., for example. He was ahead of his time because he could think outside of the context of his current generation. So when you have someone who's advocating for, his proposals would make Bernie Sanders blush. But when you have someone advocating for, let's say, a guaranteed wage, that at the time, as a way to eliminate poverty. So, at the time, you have someone thinking, or you have someone like Martin Luther King Jr. thinking, well, I want to grow up and I want my children to be in a place where race doesn't impact their lives and everyone's equal. So at the time, so what he's channeling is the future, right? So when I think of the baby boomers, I put the way they vote and the way they think into the social context of their time. So it makes complete sense that certain people would vote for a Ronald Reagan or a George W. Bush or even a Bill Clinton. And here's an example of this. So in the 90s, you have black people and black politicians supporting a crime bill and supporting the narrative that we need to get tough on crime by essentially just throwing people into jail, mass incarceration. Now, my generation, because we are a little more savvy, thanks to Michelle Alexander, we know better. So we're not going to carry that narrative isn't going to be a part of our social context, right? So what our generation says is, no, actually, we don't like the three strikes law. Actually, no, we want to decriminalize marijuana because our generation, the social context that we have is that marijuana isn't as bad as the previous generation thought, if that makes sense. So let's say the baby boomers, my parents' generation, their social narrative is that, well, I should be doing better than them. I should be able to pull myself up by my bootstraps and obtain more wealth than they did. But the beautiful thing about the millennials, and I think, unfortunately, a lot of people don't get this, well, what if that's not our narrative? What if we don't want to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps? What if we want to pull each other up? What if we don't want to be a part of just having more? What if we want to have a little less so everybody can have some?
You mean that honorable concept of live simply so others may simply live?
Exactly. And I think that's what a lot of especially the pundits don't understand. And I know, I mean, the millennials, we certainly are a little eccentric.
I'd be worried if you weren't.
Yeah, I would be too, actually. And I mean, if you look at what we've done, I mean, I'm proud to have been a part of electing not only the first black president, but at the time, the most progressive candidate who happened to be black. I'm proud of that. I'm proud that my generation supports gay marriage. I'm proud that my generation overwhelmingly supports a socialist Democrat, or a Democratic socialist. You know, that means something to me. And unfortunately, because our social context is different because of the economy, because we're a little wiser to civil rights, we don't carry the social narratives that the baby boomers or even Generation X did to a certain degree.
Well, you know, Anthony, you raise a really, really good point because, one, I've come to hate boots because of the implication of bootstraps. Because anybody that's ever done that has found out that pulling oneself, you know, that metaphor, and you're a writer, that's kind of a dodgy metaphor because anybody anybody who's ever tried to pull him or herself up by their own bootstraps has found that that's a rather difficult proposition.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, though, this pulling oneself, the concept that that each generation must do better than the one before it, mm-hmm. and you just lit this light bulb for me. There's an inherent falsity to it, and there's an inherent bias to it that I don't think you necessarily find in previous cultures or previous eras or generations or epochs. It's an American thing. It's, you know, maybe you could plant it right next to American exceptionalism, which is a freighted and dangerous and bloody idea. But I mean, this idea that it's kind of tucked in inside capitalism, isn't it? Insofar as, you know, capitalism is predicated upon the constant increase in consumption of a constantly expanding market, both of which mm-hmm. violate, you know, every law of physics. It ain't real. Mm-hmm. So maybe you're telling me that your generation has figured out the con, has stopped putting a chip down on the roulette table and just hoping that it works out. Is the next generation thing? Is it a dodge?
I would say my generation, I think we've seen a lot of bad in different elements of capitalism. So when you see a situation where the housing crisis, right? You see a situation like the Iraq war and how there's money tied to gas and people make money off of going to war. And then, you know, you have Blackwater, these private sort of henchmen of the government. And you see people make money off of private prisons. It's like everything can be capital. Everything can be capital, including people. And, you know, we have tried to avoid that in the
especially
past.
Especially
people. Yeah. And I think what's happened is, especially with the advent of social media and just some great reporting by a few prominent documentary filmmakers like Michael Moore, et cetera, we've become wise to the fact that money, the need to make money can sort of poison everything. And so, and then when it's a lot harder for us to go to college, and then to hear people, you know, the other people from, you know, baby boomers or Generation Xers say, oh, well, you guys just complain and you guys have it so easy. You guys have it. But it's like, no, it's like double or triple the price for me to go to college. It's double or triple the price for me to live. Like, you've made your living. Like, it's not going to, you didn't have to pay $200,000 for a degree in art or something. You know, like, I think my generation somehow has sort of tapped in to, it's almost going back to the message of the 60s, where it's about being inclusive and it's about it's about love and helping each other. I don't quite know how to explain how it happened. I think the Occupy Wall Street had a lot to do with it, and unfortunately they haven't received a lot of credit. But I think in a lot of ways we're getting back to a lot of the messages that were given to us by the baby boomers and Generation Xers from the 60s.
I think you may be right, and maybe it may be a little bit more refined. Because you mm-hmm. you're dealing with exigencies that, I mean, the generation that gave us the Summer of Love, such as it was, there were kids there who were going to and I think particularly of the California system, there were kids mm-hmm. who were going to college in California tuition free, because that was a real thing that used to happen in America. And so when Bernie Sanders says, let's have free tuition at public universities all across the United States, he's not saying let's have something new. He's exactly. saying let's have something we used to have until the Republicans took it away from us.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of generational differences, you know, the word democratic socialist gets bandied about a lot, and it's one of those mm-hmm. inelegant mouthful phrases, you know what I mean? And we live in an era of bumper sticker policies bumper sticker politics. Because I was raised by Depression babies, mm-hmm. and B, because I know my history as I know you do, mm-hmm. I'll almost bet you, and the shame of it is that so many of them are now gone. I'll almost mm-hmm. bet you that that the millennial generation could probably sit down with the Depression generation and find themselves, you know, once you get over the once you get over the social cultural hump of the prejudices that were all over the place in that era. But if you get to issues, if you get down to real core issues, I bet there's not a dime's worth of difference.
Probably not, actually. I wouldn't be surprised if there weren't. It's interesting. You bring up the point about at one point there was free college tuition, and that's not something new for some people. That the idea of that. I was born in 1985, so I'm 30. I just turned 30 in December. That seems like such a foreign concept to me. it almost has a sense of, wait, really? That can't be right. In America, that happened? Free yeah. College tuition?
The exception of the fat cats on the struggling Wall Street, at the crumbling Wall Street, who corkscrewed the economy into the ground during the Great Depression, at the time of the Great Depression, young people weren't saying I want free stuff. Mm-hmm. They were saying I want to eat today and tomorrow.
Yeah.
And maybe even next day.
Well, and I even say, at least in the current times, I think that we have to sort of modify the narrative of what does it mean for something to be free when you're paying for something through taxes?
Well, exactly.
You know, like that. And I guess now that I'm a part of the media, I have to sort of address this as well, but. One of the things that people say, well, Bernie Sanders just wants to give away free stuff, and it's not free. It's really an allocation of resources for things that we already pay for.
Not only is it not free, Anthony, it is damned well earned.
Exactly.
And it just galls me that you know, because that free stuff trope. Started over on the weirdo right wing emanating from the babbling mouth of Caribou Barbie, you know, the half-baked, half-baked, half-term Alaskan governor. And lo and behold, suddenly it's a talking point for Hillary's supporters. Son of a gun! Yeah. How did that happen?
Well, you know, I'm not surprised coming from... I don't mean to disparage Hillary Clinton as a person. I mean, I don't know her. My critique on her is the way in which she thinks, her thought process, and how that thought process is reflected in a presidential campaign, right? So it's not surprising that she had a husband who she supported, who says, you know, changing welfare, ending welfare, and the policies that they supported, which I think, you know, and being anti-welfare does have a small tinge of being anti-poor, a small tinge of being anti-minority, but it's certainly not a sentiment of wanting to support people. And one of the attacks on welfare was, well, you just want to give people things for free? And it's more...
Well, you know, Jesus so did.
You know, who, by the way, was a brown person who was put to death for giving people free health care.
You might be interested to know that the standard reference to him on this program is Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi. So
exactly. So if Jesus were to walk into the doors of a Donald Trump campaign or any Republican campaign, they'd probably tell him they're going to deport him, you know, back to Mexico, of course. I think when people sort of critique this idea of free stuff, it's sort of a harken back to the idea of, you know, minorities just want things for free.
Well, and that was my point. There's a dog whistle involved.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's totally what that that's exactly what it is. It's, oh, well, these people just want things for free. And we know what who they're talking about when they say, you know, these people.
Well, I mean, isn't it a direct handoff from I mean, isn't there a line that can be connected with very, very few interruptions in between Ronald Reagan talking about, well, the welfare queens, to that day in the mid 90s when Bill Clinton says the era of big government is over.
And exactly.
And everybody knows who they're talking about.
Exactly. And unfortunately, I think actually white poor people have gotten the message more so than black poor people. And it seems like after the Nevada caucus, even Latinos are starting to get the message. But I don't understand for the life of me how. Well, when you're talking about policies that impact poor people, of course, there are black and white poor people. However, what happens in black neighborhoods is that the poverty is concentrated, right? And this was part of the critique that Ta-Nehisi Coates made on Bernie Sanders, which I think is a good one to a certain degree, and I'll explain that in a second. But I think I haven't figured out why black people haven't figured out when Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton talk about, oh, well, you know, this end of big government, ending welfare, we know it. These sort of messages, they're actually talking about policies that are going to impact us disproportionately. But hopefully we'll figure it out as a group very soon.
That kind of leads into the next question, because I think part of the whole narrative of Hillary, and you use the word firewall, wow, the African American vote is that for her. I guess it gets some traction because at the same time that states like Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Louisiana, South Carolina, at the same time that those are not exactly Democratic strongholds, somehow they are afforded almost mythic status in terms of political viability. So you've got within the Democratic Party, you've got a significant African-American presence in South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, and some of those states are coming up on Super Tuesday, which is now less than a week away.
Yeah.
Does the possibility exist that somehow that's going to put paid to this dream of a responsive politics that says that the needs and the desires and the yearnings of the working class are somehow worth considering? I mean, I'm really troubled by this because, again, I'm operating from inside my own white male privilege, and I don't want to go off saying things that just prove myself to be a bigger ass than I already am. is there a conversation taking place between millennial black people and their elders? I mean,
I've been trying to have it. Honest, you know, I can say from what I know, from what I've seen, yes. But the problem is, it's a lot of preaching to the choir, I think. I've been trying to engage part of my problem is that I'm in India, so it's a little harder for me to engage people on a personal level. But from what I can see online, there are black millennials and black baby boomers and Generation Xers who support Bernie Sanders. And I've seen comments on some of my posts that have said, you know, former Clinton supporters have switched over to become Bernie Sanders supporters. But by and large, the problem The problem is that it seems as if Black Americans follow Black politicians, because that's sort of Black politicians and the church. Those are sort of the heads of our community, unfortunately. And so when you look at Black politicians, there are a lot of them who support Hillary Clinton. But when you look at the artists and the intellectuals, they support Bernie Sanders. And the hard thing is that some of the Ta-Nehisi Coates and Michelle Alexander, they haven't flat out endorsed Bernie Sanders, but they've kind of said, oh, well, we'll vote for him. And what is missing is that strong endorsement. Bernie Sanders, I think, in order to move the conversation forward, that is happening on social media, even if it's preaching to the choir. In order to move that conversation forward, I think Black Americans will need like an Al Sharpton to say, we're going to go with Bernie Sanders. A Jesse Jackson to say, we're going to go with Bernie Sanders. Or a Barack Obama to say, we're going to go with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, ain't happening. That last part ain't happening.
Yeah, no, I know. That was, as I said it, I was like, that's definitely a pipe dream. But I think that's really the only way to move the conversation forward, because the media has not, unless I'm missing something, they have not been honest about Bernie Sanders' participation in civil rights. They have not been very transparent with his policies, and they haven't been honest about Hillary Clinton's impact on, or Bill Clinton's impact on the on Black American life. And so I think a lot of it is Black people are saying, whoa, you know, we trust the Clintons. He was on Arsenio Hall playing the saxophone, and he was just great.
You know what? You would be surprised to know the number of people who are part of this community of this radio program, who have cited that Arsenio Hall moment. And I'm standing a long way back from. Really, it was that seminal.
When I think about it, I've asked myself that same question. It's like, well, what's so special about this? In its context, I can understand why it meant what it meant. You know, this is at a time when Arsenio Hall, was Arsenio Hall, and
he was not only the Arsenio Hall, he was the only Arsenio Hall.
Yeah, exactly. And you didn't really find too many presidential candidates on that show being able to play music the way Bill Clinton did. And so I think part of it was that it was something new and it was something fresh. And Bill Clinton did a hell of a job campaigning to Black Americans and did a hell of a job lobbying to the Congressional Black Caucus when he was in office. So I think taking all of that into consideration, I guess I can understand where Black people are coming from. But what I don't understand is we have so much more information now. So we know how his policies have impacted people. And he's even admitted that that's what's so mind-boggling to me is the fact that Bill Clinton admitted he regrets the crime bill, and Hillary Clinton, that's what I don't understand. And unfortunately, the media just has not done a good job of pointing these things out. So how can you say the person with the most experience is the best qualified when the experience hasn't actually impacted their ability to make the right decision? And so I just think, unfortunately, it's going to take an Al Sharpton or a Jesse Jackson, just a prominent former politician or a prominent Black leader to come out and fully endorse Bernie Sanders.
Well, you know, there was a big Bernie event in South Carolina a couple of Saturdays back. And one of the people who headlined the event and offered a a stirring endorsement of Bernie Sanders was, of course, Ben Jealous, former president of the NAACP. So those people are out there, those leaders in the community, presumed leaders. I don't know if self-anointed or not. But I think we agree that the conversation between the intergenerational conversation in the community, we hope, is more important to the process. You might be interested to know. I saw this earlier today and went, well, I'll be dipped, because you know, one of those things, and you alluded to it with the crime bill. Hillary Clinton's reference to, and again, there was dog whistling involved. Everybody knew she was talking about young black men.
The super predators.
Super predators, right.
Yeah.
Well, lo and behold, yesterday at a $500 a ticket.
The Black Lives Matter protesting.
A Black Lives Matter activist got in and unfurled a towel in front of a camera that said, "I don't need to be brought to heel," because that was the other thing she said. You know, there are super predators, and we've got we can talk about why they're that way, but they have to be brought to heel. And that's
exactly
phrase. First of all, but she did. She said, and bless her heart, she said, "You know, that's the first time anybody's ever said anything to me about that." And I'm sorry,
Hillary Clinton said that.
Yeah.
Well, she must be tone deaf.
But lo and behold, Anthony, lo and behold, she has now apologized. She's apologized for it and said that she regrets.
Well, unfortunately, I really
and that she would never say something like that today.
That's exactly what I was going to get to. That's what's dangerous, actually. That I think that's actually dangerous. I very much appreciate what the young woman and protester did, bringing that to light and asking her to apologize. I think is a great first step, but I don't care about the apology, because what we'll get instead, what we will receive is, "Oh, yep, you know, I'm sorry. I will never say anything like that again." And that's too easy.
Yeah, but will you think it?
Exactly. Will the policies you implement in the future reflect that pathology? Will you implement some sort of policy that takes on the narrative of being tough on crime, which is really about being tough on people? And those people, those super predators she spoke about, it's black and brown people. And that's what that whole speech and that whole narrative was about. And unfortunately, well, what's so sad about that is Hillary Clinton wasn't the only person to take on that narrative. There were, from my last count, 23 out of 40, and this is a lowball number. I've actually seen it a little higher. 23 members of the Congressional Black Caucus also voted in favor of the crime bill. I've actually heard the number to be 32, an overwhelming majority of the Congressional Black Caucus voted for that crime bill as well. And what's so dangerous about the whole thing is that it's reflective of a type of narrative where it's not about where Hillary Clinton didn't seem to be interested in looking at how poverty impacts crime. It's just the crime itself. And when she had an opportunity to address poverty, In that speech she gave where she said that, you're absolutely right. She said, "Well, we can talk about that, but first we have to breathe in the hill." And all she would have had to do is reverse that statement. We need to talk about how poverty, unemployment, and all these things disproportionately impact African-Americans, people of color. We need to address those things, and then we can start to address crime. And that's exactly what Bernie Sanders did. I don't know if you've read the piece I wrote, Black Progressives, It's Time to Unite. But if you go to that piece, it's on my blog. It's on the Huffington Post. I actually put videos of Bernie Sanders talking about crime right next to Hillary Clinton talking about crime. And you can see the difference in the way in which they talk about it. Bernie Sanders actually talks about crime the same exact way that Martin Luther King Jr. did. And Martin Luther King Jr. said, well, we cannot talk about crime. We can't talk about all these things that plague America if we don't address poverty. And we can't just address poverty. We have to talk about eliminating poverty. We have to have a war on poverty. We have to have a war on unemployment. We have to address these things. That's the only way we're going to address crime. And when you watch Bernie Sanders talk about crime, he flat out says those things. And not only that, he explicitly, and I think this is in 1994, Bernie Sanders was in strong opposition to the crime bill. And he was talking about the death penalty component of the bill. And he said, we can't talk about crime without addressing poverty and unemployment. And we need to do that instead of disproportionately targeting blacks. Those were like his exact words. And so to hear that and then listen to Hillary Clinton, it's just the difference in their narratives. And again, it's not to disparage Hillary Clinton as a person,
no,
but it's the way she thinks about these things. It's her thought process and the way in which she arrives at conclusions. I don't think she has ever seen positions she doesn't like. She will take any position that is popular. I mean,
apart from saying we will never ever have universal single payer health care, she has actually Bernie hasn't moved toward her positions. She has done a lot more moving toward toward Bernie's positions. I heard some comic wag say the other day that if she gets much closer to Bernie's position, she's going to turn into an old white Jewish guy. But I mean, there's an element of truth to it. That's why it's funny. But you know, you mentioned something a couple of minutes ago, Anthony. And I think it is, I think it's worth a pause. You know, you said war on crime, a war. You know, do you think from a philosophical or from a spiritual place, maybe we might do well to stop seeing everything in this country in terms of a war?
I think so. But I take Barack Obama's position slightly on this one. One he had in the, I think it was 2000 and I want to say 2006. I can't remember when he said this, but when he said, "I don't oppose all wars. I oppose stupid wars." And I think if there is something that we could have a war on, I think poverty would be a great start. I think if we are going to have something to go to war with, then I would say poverty would be that one. But I do agree, it would be nice to stop thinking in terms of war for once. There's something I did want to kind of go back to, if that's okay.
Yes, please, because I hope it's the same thing I heard you reference a little bit ago. Let's see if we're on the same wavelength.
Okay, I talked about a critique Ta-Nehisi Coates made on Bernie Sanders.
That one.
Okay. So Ta-Nehisi Coates talked about, he wrote an article in The Atlantic, and it was, "Why precisely is Bernie Sanders against reparations?" And I haven't had a chance to finish writing about this, so hopefully I can address it now. And people have used this narrative to attack Bernie Sanders. So black people would say, oh, well, he's not for reparations. Well, obviously, neither is Hillary Clinton. So you can't criticize one candidate without criticizing the other for the same position. But more so than that, I think people miss the point. The reason why you can critique Bernie Sanders for not supporting reparations, it isn't a bad thing in itself. The idea that there isn't sort of a moral or political equivalency to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton's platform is absolutely right. And because Bernie Sanders is a democratic socialist and because he is a champion for civil rights, we get to hold him to a higher level of standard. And I think that actually is a good thing. The reason why people don't critique Hillary Clinton for being against reparations is because we don't expect her to be for it in the first place.
Amen.
And that tells you something about the difference. Now, do I think it's a reason to not vote for Bernie Sanders? No, not at all. But I think because he is a democratic socialist and because he supports civil rights, he sort of has to be accountable for the positions that he has ascribed to himself. But I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's actually a good thing. The reason why it makes sense to question him on it is because he's saying he supports a redistribution of wealth. And again, that's not a bad thing. That's actually a good thing. And so I just didn't want to make it. I didn't want to make it seem as if I was in favor of blindly sort of critiquing Bernie Sanders for being against reparations.
I didn't think you were. I think it's a discussion we should have, Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'll say what apparently is not supposed to be said. I wholeheartedly support trying to have some level of reparations, mm-hmm. and I support it especially within the context of, say, something along the lines of a truth and reconciliation effort.
Yeah.
Because there's so much history down the rabbit hole. You know, one of those things that Hillary did when she said, you know, when she made that reference in the under the rubric or the question of who was your favorite president, and she said Abraham Lincoln. And then said, you know, had Lincoln lived, we might not have gone through the horrors of Reconstruction. Well, mm-hmm. Reconstruction wasn't the horror. The horror was the privileged white response to it. The terrorism campaign that was waged for a decade against it. The rise of the Klan, the Knight Rider, everything that went with it, that was the horror, not the attempt to fully enfranchise a recently freed population and integrate them into the body politic.
Yeah, exactly, and you're right, and it's all about the conversation, and I think it is worth one having, whether or not one agrees or disagrees. I just think in this context, with the reparation conversation and it being a critique on Bernie Sanders, I think we have to take it not his position as the good thing, but the fact that it's a position that he can be that he can at least be asked about, I think is the more powerful statement.
Well, and going all the way back, Anthony, to when the event unfolded at Netroots Nation, mm-hmm. you know, I it says something that they went to Bernie, and of course, yes. Governor O'Malley was there as well. I wish Bernie had handled it a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, over the course of time, he has shown a willingness to learn.
Yep.
And a desire to go up that learning curve. It felt like, you know, there was really no point in going to Hillary with it.
Exactly.
But in South Carolina yesterday, there was a point. And mm-hmm. I'm just proud as punch. And what does this say? And I hope I'm not taking too much of your time because I'm enjoying this conversation.
Me as well. I have the day off, so
this is not like work.
Keep that.
one of the backstories about what happened in Charleston, South Carolina yesterday, and there's video of it, and you can mm-hmm. see that it's at a positively lovely, lovely home. I can't resist the silly voices sometimes. You'll have to forgive me. But one of the backstories was that in order to get close enough to be able to get this message out, it cost those two activists $500 apiece in order to be able to do that. You have to pay out of your own pocket to confront an American politician with that American politician's own record. Because the four, you know, Chuck Todd over at NBC and George Snuffleupagus over at ABC, they're never going to ask her about that. So those two people had to decide, okay, so maybe I don't eat so well for the next month. This has to be done. And I find that, well, kind of horrifying.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I mean, not only is it sad that the young woman had to be escorted out, and Hillary Clinton didn't seem to mind, didn't say, hey, no, let her stay, I'll address her question, which she would have done if it had been a town hall. But you're right. The other problem is that before this event, why is it that no one in the media said, hey, what's wrong with this picture? Hillary Clinton, someone who's being criticized for the way money impacts her politics, is having an event where people have to pay $500 to get in. Like that, I just cannot believe. I can't believe. It's just so.
I mean, by contrast, when Bernie was confronted in what, Seattle? Didn't cost a nickel to do that.
Nope. But it's not surprising because it's the way in which the politicians think. It's their thought process. So, I mean, I actually would be surprised if Bernie Sanders had an event where people had to pay that much money, because I think from what I know of him, he would have said, well, we can't have an event that excludes the working class or poor people. That's...
Well, because when you get to having those, it's time to hang up your, just take the populist button and just put it back in the drawer.
Exactly.
Because you're not anymore.
Exactly. And he knows, and he knows that you can't take that money without pandering to those people. And he is not going to pander to those people. And so I think, again, it just shows a different thought process. Well, Bernie Sanders wants to close, he wants to end contracts for state and federal private prisons. And we know he can do it because he doesn't take money from people, from private prisons. Unlike Hillary Clinton and members of the CBC PAC, who have received money from lobbyists from CCA. And it's just, and I think that tells you something. I mean, again, going back to this whole idea of black people supporting Bernie Sanders, you have the Congressional Black Caucus PAC receiving money from a lobbyist to private prisons. Like but yet when Bernie Sanders says, oh, well, I'm going to end that. There will be no more contracts for state, local, and federal private prisons. Well, Bernie Sanders doesn't really care about black people, as one of the members said. Oh, well, he's only been talking about it for 40 days, but yet this has been his platform for, almost 40 years, if anything. But yeah, it's that situation where people had to pay $500 to go to this event, and then this woman holds up a sign, and then Hillary Clinton, you can just watch how she treats this woman. I mean, obviously she was Hillary Clinton was upset. She was interrupted, and yes, the protest was disruptful. But I mean, that's sort of the point.
That's and in the nature. But the thing was, they were respectful.
I completely agree.
And all she said was, you know, you said this, and before she wasn't monologuing before Hillary said, "Can I speak?"
Mm-hmm.
And oh my God, the just the overweening privilege that mm-hmm. that with which those words were freighted. Well, what were you doing? It's not that. Go ahead, please speak about this. Tell mm-hmm. us. Yeah. And there are so many of those issues that circulate. And I've been critiqued for spending too much time talking about, you know, about Hillary's record, as opposed to talking about why Bernie is Star Spangled Awesome, which he is. Mm-hmm. But I also tend to think that, I mean, this is a very pro Bernie community that we have here. And toward that end, I trust that that our community, being very intelligent people, have bothered to educate themselves. What worries me is the sliming that is now going on. From the invention of Bernie Bros, which in itself is a form of cultural appropriation from the black community, you know, the use of the word bro, and I'm going, wow, is anybody paying attention?
Yeah, well, we normally hang an A instead of, you know, we I don't know what it is with us and word ending words with A's, but we tend to end it with an A. But I get no, but you're right. I think the problem is we have to seek out so much information about Bernie Sanders if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, because the media does not cover it. If you're a Hillary Clinton supporter, the information is everywhere. I probably spent 20 hours researching for the last article I wrote, Black Progressives Time to Unite Against Establishment Politics, because the information is so hard to find. And I don't know how, I don't know why no one in the media has pointed this out. I'm not a huge, this whole email thing with Hillary Clinton.
Don't care.
Yeah, it's not a big deal. However, I will say this. If there are emails that talks about that or a hint at the simple fact she has controlled the press, that she has manipulated or impacted reporting on issues, that to me is a problem. That's of all the email thing, that is the one to me I think is one of the most telling, because that's how we are supposed to get our information. Journalists have a responsibility to give information to people. And if you have a situation where there are emails that suggest that Hillary Clinton is overly friendly with, let's say, the New York Times, I think that's a problem.
Because that whole sort of incestuous relationship with, say, an outfit like the New York Times has proven to be problematic in the past, to mm-hmm. wit, a certain run-up to a certain illegal preemptive war.
Exactly.
In favor of which she voted. Let me touch on something that you've sort of broached here as well. I agree that would be concerning within the email scandal. But you know, my pink little ears don't perk up when I hear the word Benghazi.
Yeah, neither do I.
But I and I'll tell you. I don't know if you know, but I'll tell you where I am. You know, I've said repeatedly that I will work for Bernie Sanders, that I will advocate for Bernie Sanders, that I want Bernie Sanders to be the nominee. But if in November she's the nominee, I'm going to vote for her.
Well, yeah, yeah.
And I know, but there's a lot within the progressive, a lot of people within the progressive community, hell no. But I'm gonna. But that having been said, I do think it's critical, even understanding, Anthony, the critique that you and I have offered of you know, so-called mainstream party politics, and knowing what the shortcomings are of the privileged power elite inside Democratic Party circles. An America with President Trump is absolutely unspeakable to me. And so I say all of that as a preface, and please tell me what you think. The idea of the transcripts, the speech transcripts, because I have, I go back to 2012 and I think about what Bishop Willard Romney did to himself with his 47% comment. And I'll be honest, I'm scared to death that there's something like that in those speech transcripts.
Well, I agree. I think she should release the transcripts, first of all. And I think, at first she says, well, when everybody releases them, I'll release mine. And again, that tells you something about her way of thinking. When everyone else does something, I will do it. Here's how you can translate this politically. So she says, with in relation to the transcripts, well, when everyone else does it, I will do it. Well, when everyone else is supporting for gay marriage, I'll do it. When everyone else supports universal health care, I'll support it.
When everybody else realizes the Iraq war was a disaster, it'll dawn on me too.
Exactly. And that's her, that is Hillary Clinton's mentality. That's her thought process. And I mean, now she's even, I've read reports, she's gone on to say, well, when the Republicans do it. And it's just, so now you're comparing yourself to a Republican. It's like, no, you're the Democrat. Like, you have a high responsibility to live up to the qualities that you have ascribed for yourself. Why are you lowering those standards to that of Republican?
Well, and here's my greater fear, though, Anthony. Mm-hmm. I think those speeches, I think somebody's already got them. Now, this is not the Alex Jones portion of the program or anything, but yeah. I've got too long a history and an experience of watching Republican dirty politics and dirty tricks politics. Okay, I think somebody's already got them, and if she's the nominee, then sometime long about October, surprise, they'll come out, and they will beat her over the head with them. And we will wind up with President whoever the RNC nominee is. So I think it's bad politics, Anthony, not to immunize yourself against them now, because you know when everybody else does, well, there's not going to be an everybody else. She's not running in the Republican primary.
Exactly.
And after the conventions, there's only going to be one other candidate. I mean, what, is she waiting for Jill Stein to release her transcripts? Because I'm pretty sure Dr. Stein would do that. Bernie's already released the transcripts of the three speeches that he gave for money to the tune of $1,800, which he gave to charity.
Yep, exactly.
And Hillary, you know, whereas Hillary's $675,000 reminds me of W.C. Fields saying, I always try to give to the poor. Poor me.
Yeah. Well, and it tells you something. I mean, the moment she was asked about it, she said, well, I'll look into it. You are a former first lady and running for president. You don't need to look into anything. Things are either a yes or a no. Like, there is no, I can look into releasing the transcripts. It's either I don't want to, or I can't, or I will, or I won't. And the reason why the transcripts haven't come out is because she's had to pander to these people to receive money, but then yet says, oh, well, can you bring up any time I've been influenced by money, or, you know, one of my policies have been impacted by a political donation? Well, if they haven't, then you can show us the transcripts and we can be the judge of that.
Exactly. Hey, Anthony, we've had a marvelous conversation, but I am intrigued by the fact that you are in India, as you mentioned.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
could I be so bold as to ask you what took you there?
Yeah. Oh, of course. Let's see. So I was teaching at a school in San Diego called High Tech High, by far the best school in the world. And a teacher who had been in contact with a school here in Mumbai had asked me, he said, "Hey, do you want to go to India?" And I said, "No, I don't want to go to India, actually." And he said, "Well, there's a school that's looking for a director and a humanities teacher." And I was teaching sixth grade humanities at the time. And at first I said, no, I was really at that point in my life. This is the October before last. At that point in my life, I was really focused on getting my career going as a journalist. I had started, but then I stopped and then started again. But teaching, really, it's your life. It's not a job. It's your life. It's what you do. It's who you are. And so, anyway, to make a long story short, I ended up moving to India to start a middle school. And that's what I'm doing right now.
You'll forgive me if I just say, damn, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. It's been, you know, it's funny. When I came here, I said, okay, my life is not going to be eat, pray, love. It's not going to be eat, pray, love. It's not going to be eat, pray, love. That's been my mantra. And sure enough, it has slightly been eat, pray, love. But it's okay. That's what I hear India does to people. So, yeah. So
You don't come back the same person. I've never met anyone who did.
No, and what's the most interesting thing is that the culture shock is greater going back to the States.
Would you care to elaborate? Because that's not just, I mean, that seems kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah, that's what I thought. When I arrived, everyone looks like me, but everyone doesn't look like me at the same time. Because I mean, in terms of my skin color, I sort of blend in, but I definitely have, you know, African and American features to me. Like, you can definitely, when you talk to me, you can tell I'm an expat, I'm an American expat. But
yeah, you don't sound like most of the English speakers over there, I'll bet.
No, exactly. And so when I look around, everyone is brown. When you walk out to the streets, it's like there are just a lot of Indian people. I'm in India. And when I came back, home in December, and I went to a shopping mall, and I almost had a panic attack because of just the amount of diversity that was in the mall. And it was so powerful, and it was just so different, and America has a different feel. And there's something in the air in India that's slightly different than, I mean, obviously outside the smog and pollution, out than the air in America. But it's hard to explain. It's always been hard. It's been more of I don't know. It's been harder to adapt going back home than it is when I'm here.
Well, you know what Thomas Wolfe said. Can't go home again.
Yeah.
But I found in the course of preparing for our conversation, I received, and this is serendipitous, I received a link to a story from a dear friend of the program, Sandra. I'm not sure if you're aware of it or not, but the World Trade Organization, another one of those lovely, neoliberal globalist kind of affairs. Uh-huh. I'm sure, being in India, you're aware that India is desperately trying to prepare for the future, trying to get away from some fossil fuels, although they're ramping up their own coal production. But they have a huge solar initiative in line with the agreements that were hammered out in Paris in December. Well, the World Trade Organization has just put a smackdown on India.
Really, I did not know this actually.
The solar program has a component in it that says a certain percentage of the solar infrastructure has to be domestically produced. So the United States of America went to court against India.
Oh, wow.
And won a case claiming that India was engaging in protectionism by not simply letting the rest of the world kill its fledgling solar industry. And won.
Wow, I did not know that. I did, however, just go on a field trip with some of my students to look at the ways in which India is using solar panels to power a hospital that's made for the poor, and it's in a really tiny village. And actually, I've seen a school that I want to say it was running on 98% renewable energy. One of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my entire life. But I did not know about this lawsuit that America filed against India.
I have a feeling it's not going to be taken too very kindly. And you know, to the extent that what does that say about this country's commitment to joining the world in combating climate change? What, as long as we can make a buck at it? I mean, China has a solar industry that's shooting through the roof. But the United States is the one that brought the lawsuit.
Well, if I think sort of in this, I think as long as people like the Koch brothers can give infinite amount of money to our politicians, none of these things are going to change.
I think you're absolutely right.
I know that sounds pessimistic, but I really do believe when people have to make a living, when people have to support their families, I think, and there's a situation where someone can give or donate money to a politician, I think these sorts of things are always going to happen. I mean, people don't immediate impacts of climate change, especially in America. So for someone, why don't you vote against this clean air initiative, or why don't you vote against this other, you know, this use of wind power or solar energy or whichever it may be? Then it's like, oh, okay, well, climate change, it's not that bad right now, so I can go ahead and take this money and vote against it.
I mean, if you want to go looking for it, Anthony, the story is at Grist. Grist.org. Mm-hmm. But one of the numbers cited there that was amazing to me is that roughly there is a population in India who live without electricity equal to the population of the entire United States.
Well, I'll have to check that number. I've been looking. My students are doing research right now on poverty in India. I'll check, but it actually isn't surprising. Access to things that I've always been used to having access to, and I still have access to them. I am definitely privileged here, but I've seen things that I cannot unsee. I guess I'll put it like that.
Understood. Well, Anthony, this has been one of the most engaging 90 minutes that I have spent in a very long time. Would you please tell people how they can keep track of your doings, your writings, what you're up to?
Yeah, sure. Feel free to either email me, and my email can be found on my blog at www.blackandwordy.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at A.E. Conright. And also my Facebook page, Black and Wordy, as well.
Okay. Okay. Wonderful. Well, I'm going to be reading what you write in the future, and I'm so glad that Carol Baker found your essay. Feel free to chime in with your thoughts anytime along the way. For folks who didn't get to listen to the program live, the conversation live, the archive will go up online. Oh, probably within about an hour or so after the program ends this evening. I applaud the noble work you're doing, and I'm glad whoever made a writer out of you made a writer out of you. Mm-hmm. And let's just hope great things happen for Bernie, and better things happen for him, even better things happen for the United States in the future, because we can't go backwards.
I agree. I do want to say, because I'm a teacher, I always appreciate it when students, you know, tell me how I've impacted them. And so if I can, those two gentlemen that started the genesis of my writing career, Dr. Lee Walters and Will Turner, thank you so much for making us write that that dreaded 30-page journal over the summer, because if you hadn't, I wouldn't be where I am today. So thank you.
Well, Anthony Conright, thank you again so very much for giving us so much of your time, and I wish you the very best. And again, I look forward to reading more of your thoughts, and perhaps another time, another conversation here.
Oh, I would love that. Anytime. Just let me know.
All right. Thank you so kindly. And have a, is it morning?
Yeah, it's about 6 a.m.
Wow. You got up early. Thank you. So, well, thank you for that too, especially on your day off. Thank you very kindly.
No
and
problem.
have a great day.
Okay. You too. Have a wonderful evening.
Bye now.
Bye.
Anthony Conright. You can find his writings at blackandwordy.com, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. There were some great responses along the way. Let's see. The marvelously coherent Diane in Kansasstan said regarding Mr. Conright, he says his generation has the narrative of pulling each other up by the bootstraps. Ah, the wisdom. Changes, Diane notes, may be in the making. Hear, hear. Thank you, Heather. Heather said it was a nice interview. Mark writes in and says, what a breath of fresh air with common sense and practical sensibility. Very good, Anthony. Signed, Mark, who campaigned as a younger man for RFK. Meanwhile, in the frozen north, Ron says simply, this guest is good. And I couldn't agree more. Over on the Twitters, Ms. Curtis Brooks says, great show, guys. Loved it. And she's been tweeting along throughout the conversation. A lot of good observations. At one point, she noted that she was as baffled as anybody at how the free stuff meme went from Sarah Palin to the Clinton campaign. Yeah, wow. I mean, that really is something to ponder, isn't it? I love conversations like this because they're not transactional. They are far more, I think, related to an earnest desire to sort some common sense out of an often mad world. Thomas over at FYINation.com says that was an awesome long-form interview. You reminded me of why I love giving, and you do a great one, too. Now, I'm glad we didn't cut you off since we do at 8 p.m. for the debate. It's not you, says Thomas. It's me. Oh, God. So, I think, and going back, thinking back to, for instance, our conversation about there was a time when education was affordable in this country. Glenn says, I recall paying around $280 per semester at West Virginia University. Alma mater. So I think a break is in order. Thank you very kindly to the marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas, Dan, for getting us started on fundraising this evening. We ended with a significant deficit last night. And I think our fundraising goal is somewhere north of $400 this evening. I'd say it's probably right at $400, thanks to Diane. We'll just play it by ear from there, shall we? The PayPal button is over at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute, and of course the mailing address. You know that, most of you, but it's the Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801. Now, we'll take a break here in a sec and see where the program takes us after that. This is, after all, conversation radio. We also have the Green News Report coming up, this here being Thursday, Thorn in the Side Thursday. And yes, just in case you were thinking that we had gotten away with avoiding the thorns, we haven't. Oh no, oh no. All of that and more on the way for the remainder of this Thorn in the Side Thursday on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's Thursday, February 25,
2016.
It was, it is, a simple case of letting the market work. We're going to let everybody compete.
Saudi Arabia declines to help U.S. oil companies survive oil's downturn. Big Coal's new trick to get out of paying retired coal miners' pensions. Sea levels rising faster than at any time in the last 3,000 years. Plus,
this is a global public good to invent something that can solve this problem.
Microsoft billionaire Bill Gates proposes a billion-dollar breakthrough energy research fund. So why aren't renewable energy experts happy?
I don't know, but I suspect we're about to find out. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The Clean Power Plan aims to cut carbon pollution 32% below 2005 levels by 2030. That's not possible. Not without going back to the Stone Age. For one thing, you'd have to stop human beings from exhaling.
Well, all I can tell you is that this planet will be better off when Rush Limbaugh stops exhaling. Just saying, this is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, coal is in trouble, and now oil is in trouble. It's not a great time to be in the fossil fuel industry, it seems.
No, it certainly isn't. And it looks like we are going to see cheap oil for a while longer. At an annual oil industry conference in Houston this week, the Saudi Arabia oil minister confirmed that Saudi Arabia will not cut its own production in order to stop the global oil glut.
That is not going to happen because not many countries are going to deliver. Even if they say they will cut production, they will not deliver. So there is no sense in wasting our time seeking production cuts. Let some inefficient supplies decline, and eventually the market will balance.
Those inefficient supplies he's referring to are U.S. oil producers, whose costs are too high to survive much longer with such low prices. Saudi Arabia is keeping prices low in order to be the last oil producer standing.
Hey, it's the free market, U.S. oil producers. You guys love that, right?
Coal is also in decline in the U.S., with major coal companies now declaring bankruptcy. But Big Coal is using those bankruptcy laws to legally shed their employee pension and health care obligations and the environmental costs of cleaning up closed mines. There was a bipartisan aid package in Congress to restore coal miner pensions and health care, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from the coal state of Kentucky just blocked it.
You mean the Republicans aren't fighting like hell to take care of these coal miners who they say they must protect, and that's why we can't get rid of coal because, oh, the poor coal miners?
That's right.
They're hypocrites. Who saw that one coming?
Meanwhile, a new study finds that sea levels are now rising faster than at any time in the last 3,000 years, and that the rate is accelerating, especially over the last 100 years, thanks to man-made global warming. The researchers say if no action is taken to cut emissions, they calculate the ocean could rise as much as 4 feet by 2100 and will continue to rise for centuries. And yet another new study finds that cutting the emissions that cause global warming will also save more money than it costs. That's because it will save lives by reducing toxic air pollution, a leading cause of death worldwide. Researchers calculated that cutting emissions would ultimately save the U.S. economy alone about $250 billion a year by avoiding the healthcare costs from all the asthma, lung cancer, and heart disease that Americans will not be suffering. Billionaire Microsoft founder Bill Gates this week said he and other billionaires are going to mobilize billions in private capital for a new breakthrough clean energy research and development fund to combat climate change.
The group of private investors would bring several billion in so that we can nurture these companies up to a pretty large stage. But we do expect to make money out of this thing. It's great that we have that incentive, the financial incentives to get it out at scale quickly, and that's also the climate benefit requires that same mentality.
However, energy experts like Joe Rome at Climate Progress say that while they welcome new research funding, what we really need now is billions for deployment. We already have the technology we need, they say, to transition the world to renewable energy, but we need money to build it faster. And time spent on waiting on breakthroughs could be better spent building wind and solar and battery storage.
Yeah, but, you know, the guy who created Windows, for some reason, wants to make things way more complicated. I have no idea why. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
About 14 minutes before the hour on this Thorn in the Side Thursday at the Horn, the 25th day of February 2016, and I referenced the confrontation with Dr. Senator Secretary Clinton down in South Carolina in Charleston that cost them $500 apparently a piece to be able to do. I thought you might. I thought you might find the audio perhaps a little bit useful, having talked about it. It starts with an explanation of the phrase.
Sure that South Carolina became the first state with body cameras. There's more work to be done, but you got to lay down these markers. You got to build toward common sense gun reform, criminal justice.
Hillary turns. She has suddenly seen the protester.
I think we've got somebody saying here, we have to bring them to heal. Okay, we'll talk about it.
I'm not a super predator, Hillary Clinton.
Okay, fine, we'll talk about it.
You apologize to black people for mass incarceration?
Well, can I talk? And then maybe you can listen to what I say. Okay, fine. Thank you very much. There's a lot of issues in this campaign. The very first speech that I gave back in April was about criminal justice reform and about
predators. You're being rude.
You're being rude. Stop being rude.
Yeah, okay. But again, she has apologized and she said she would never say that now. See Anthony Conright's take on never say that now. So then there's this. Also in South Carolina, last summer. It was July the 22nd when Joyce Kernell, oh God. You know, when a sentence starts, it was July 22nd when Joyce Kernell, you know how to fill in the rest of the sentence, don't you? And you know who Joyce Kernell is, or at least what color her skin is. Joyce Kernell lived on Edisto Island. And, of course, the South Carolina Lowcountry is, well, almost indescribable. But Joyce Kernell was not the kind of folks who live on, the resort parts of the South Carolina Lowcountry. She was having health problems. Joyce Kernell was. All this past tense. She was 50 years old, and she was having stomach problems. And so 911 was called,
And she was transported from Edisto Island, South Carolina, to Roper Hospital. She'd been vomiting. She was nauseated. And the ER staff there at Roper Hospital diagnosed her with gastroenteritis, which is painful and dangerous. For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. So while she was at the hospital, and this is encouraging, while she was at the hospital, somebody dropped the dime on Joyce Cornell, 50 years old, of Edisto Island, South Carolina. Because if because you can be imprisoned in South Carolina for being in debt. Somehow or another, during her time at the hospital, someone alerted law enforcement officers to the fact that Joyce Cornell had an outstanding bench warrant for her arrest. Whew. She owed $1,148.90 in fines from a previous shoplifting case. She had been paying on that $1,148.90 from April 2012 to January 2013. After that, she stopped paying. And that's when the court issued a bench warrant for her arrest. So last July, when she had the attack of gastroenteritis and was taken to the hospital, somebody dropped the dime to law enforcement officers, and they came and arrested Joyce Cornell at the emergency room. Or in the hospital, I should say. And they took her out of the hospital. And they took her to jail. And they took her to jail on July the 21st, and on July the 22nd, 2015, she died. No, she wasn't beaten. No, she wasn't tased. She wasn't pepper sprayed. She was just gravely ill. They took her to the Charleston County Jail, where an independent agency, an independent for-profit agency called the Carolina Center for Occupational Health, had been contracted to provide basic health care services to people who had been put in custody in that jail. Mm-hmm. When she was taken to the jail, even though she had been taken out of a hospital bed, they put her in what's referred to euphemistically as a housing unit, instead of transporting her directly from the hospital to the jail's infirmary. They put her in the hospital unit and gave her a trash bag into which she could vomit because she did not have the strength to go and vomit into to make the distance to a restroom or to, you know, any sort of a toilet. You know, it grieves me that this is... I don't want this to happen anywhere on Earth, but the fact that this happens in the United States of America is disgusting, heartbreaking, and I would hope, and within the Horn Family Community Congregation, I think, undoubtedly, unacceptable. But see, if they had taken her to the infirmary instead of the housing unit, well, that would have meant that the jail and the county would have had to pay more money to the Carolina Center for Occupational Health. Right? By the next morning, she was too ill to eat what passes for breakfast there at the county jail. She wasn't given any water. There are no records of any water being provided to her. And a physician, Dr. Maria Gibson of Medical University Hospital, said, simply put, Ms. Cornell died because she was deprived of water. Her death most likely would have been preventable had she been properly treated for dehydration and the irritation of her stomach and the rest of her digestive tract. An intravenous bag of saline. God almighty, how much does one of those even cost? How much is the markup on an intravenous bag of saline for the Carolina Center for Occupational Health? Apparently, jail officials, having already screwed up and put her in a housing unit instead of in the infirmary, did ask the Carolina Center for Occupational Health staffers, independent contractors on board, to render assistance, but they didn't. Thank you, Texas Betsy. Texas Betsy says a bag of intravenous saline costs about $1 to produce, and hospitals charge $500. That probably means it would be a $1,000 bag of saline to Charleston County. Because, of course, there's a CEO at the Carolina Center for Occupational Health. And the CEO, ain't eating beans. So, for something less than $1,148.90 here in South Carolina, United States of Merca, the greatest country in the world on earth now, today, forever, indivisible, in the universe, under God, amen. In God we trust. A 50-year-old woman, a 50-year-old black woman, didn't get to become a 51-year-old black woman. Could we get, do you think we could maybe work, under the general heading of that more perfect union part of the preamble of the Constitution, you think we could try to come to a place where maybe, just maybe, kind of, sort of, we don't let this kind of thing happen anymore? Debtor's prison. She died of neglect in debtor's prison. See, that's the thing. You could hand the copy of this story to, say, zombie Charles Dickens, and he'd say, "Oh yes, my good man, happens all the time. I try to do my part with my, in my writing to draw attention to the to these sorts of problems here in the." Here in the UK, well, you know, progress is slow now, isn't it? What? This is the United States of America in the 21st century, and you've still not solved it? Oh, bugger. Right. Down in Shreveport, Jack says, kind of seems more real when you realize that you, me, and many other Horn listeners are about 50 years old, too. Oh, yes. In New York, Steve says, "I want to be angry, but I'm too sad." I know. Meanwhile, out in the great Northwest, Cindy says, "The sick lady who died of dehydration, sons of bitches. Damn them all to their self-invented and therefore materialized hell. I want you to mention that their ability to murder this woman for a debt owed is allowed under the new Bankruptcy Reform Act, which, by the way, must be revoked. Our old ways worked for fine for the entire 20th century. Worked fine. This is an evil law." Well, to be fair, it's not the Bankruptcy Reform Act, Cindy, that did that. It's the fact that if you enter into a payment agreement, especially in certain southern states, subsequent to a criminal conviction, and for any reason you're not able to pay, they can come get your ass. Is Merca. Yeah. By the way, lines are open. 304-574-8178, 304-663-4676 if you want to participate in the conversation. Skype to Skype is simply Bob Kincaid Horn. Which works all the way to, you know, India, as we found out this evening. Works all over the planet. Well, if you've never sent me a contact request and you would like to be involved in the conversation, please feel free so to do. And, Thomas mentioning that, there's another Republican pageant tonight. I guess people will be tuning in to see if now that T-Rump has eliminated Jebbia, if he'll squash little Marco Rubio inside his empty suit, or if he'll try to wipe out Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, the future anointed king of America, son of Rafael Eduardo Cruz, the man who forgot to become an American for a very long time. If you have not, by the way, if you have not read Matt Taibbi's latest over at Rolling Stone, which is a lengthy examination of the Trump phenomenon, and among the best written explanations of it I've come across, well, you should. Like I said, it's lengthy. So I'm not going to sit here and read it to you. But he goes to pains to point out that some of the things Trump is talking about are absolutely true. And that is not by any sense, by any means, an endorsement of Trump. He stalks my sleeping moments like some sort of revenant nightmare creature. But there's a lot of telling stuff in there, and one of the hallmarks of great writing, at least for me, is that it gets me thinking down my own paths. And you know, the way that Trump absolutely destroyed Jebya did get me thinking. Was it, I can't remember if it was 2004 or 2000. I was on the air for 2004. But at some point in time, back then, Donald Trump was said to be contemplating a presidential run. And you know, if he had run in 2000, if he had treated Dim Leader like he treated Jebya, do you realize, well, A, Al Gore probably would have been elected. There would have been no 9/11. There would have been no illegal war in Iraq. Nothing. I think the debate starts at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I don't even know who's carrying it. Because one of the other things that Matt Taibbi brings up is that one of the things Trump has shown is that that the American political process is one great big reality TV show. And I kind of got a little bit of pleasure out of that because years now, I'm the one who's been referring to these so-called debates as pageants. And they only become more similar thereto with every passing one. Go read it. It's worth your time. Let's run over and see who's on the line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's Harry from Baltimore.
Well, hey, what's Harry, how are you?
Okay, I'm fine, and I thought I'd call. I was waiting for others to call, but when nobody immediately called, since I did something on my mind, I thought I might as well get you started.
Very good.
Well, first of all, I thought your discussion with your guest was wonderful, Mr. Conrad, and I guess Carol Baker should be thanked profusely for having discovered him or found him and his work on the internet. And I, in a sense, wanted to talk about some of the issues that you talked about with him, and I don't want to feel like I'm repeating things that you have already brought up with him. But as you know, I sent you an email this morning about a book talk here in Baltimore, involving the very talented, and I'm not even sure what her affiliation still is with MSNBC, but I know that they have not been, very kind to her in the last year. Joanne Reed is a very talented,
yes,
African American female journalist, and I mean, more than just a journalist, she's a very smart person, graduate of, went to college at Harvard, so, you know, her, have a lot of respect for her. Anyway, she has written a book which is very relevant to what you were talking to Mr. Conrad about, and it's called Fracture, and it's about the Democratic Party, and she basically wanted to go back and try to figure out, in a sense, you know, what happened with the party and its various sectors from the Clinton era onwards and into Obama, and whether you know, and sort of try to also kind of look at the complicated question of to what extent is Hillary Clinton actually, you know, in a sense, going to move forward Obama's agenda, or to what extent is it, you know, really just artificial, and to what extent did Bill Clinton, in fact, although he, you know, had a lot of support in the African-American community, but did he, in a sense, in his administration, perhaps with her consent, in many ways, you know, screw them over. So, and this book talk, which was at the Central Public Library of Baltimore, it's called the Enoch Pratt Free Library, and there's a central building in downtown Baltimore, and it was recorded, and there was a moderator who is probably the most intelligent and progressive talk show host locally in Baltimore. His name is Mark Steiner. He's happens to be Jewish, but and he grew up in Baltimore, and he was very involved in the civil rights movement in Baltimore. So he actually has a fair amount of respect within the black community here in Baltimore. And as some people probably know, the demographics of Baltimore right now are basically that African-Americans in the city I'm talking about, which is where I live, African-Americans are about 63% of the population, and Hispanics are about 5%. And then there are, of course, other minority groups with many other smaller amounts, percentages. And the reason that I wrote you was that because although I think her book basically really is a critique of the Clintons, and certainly wanting to, you know, and in many ways does kind of, sort of provide lots of facts that basically show Bill Clinton as not, you know, as inconsistent and perhaps as betraying the African-American community. There was, at the end, a question-answer period, a short period, but still. And the question came up about reparations, you know, for slavery. And Ms. Reed immediately spoke to it. And, I wasn't there. This was just audio, so I don't know the composition of the audience. But clearly, this seemed to be a topic that people were interested in. And she said, and this is my recollection, I haven't gone back to listen to the recording, but what I do remember from listening to it is that, well, first of all, two things. Basically, first of all, she talked about the first part of Senator Sanders' answer, which is also quoted in Ta-Nehisi Coates' original article of January 19th. And then she also, in a sense, echoed what Mr. Coates had said, which is, why is it that Bernie says he wants to do all of these other things that require a great deal of political imagination and are not practical, and yet he says that reparation, that he says the likelihood of getting reparations through Congress is nil. And that's almost a direct quote, because Mr. Coates quotes the whole answer in his article, which I'm looking at right now. But what concerned me, and I bring this up, and I was very reluctant. I'm hesitant to, because I don't want people to get the wrong impression, and they might. But the second part of his answer, he said, well, here's what his answer was. No, I don't think so. And when he's asked, you know, should there be reparations for slavery? Then he says, first of all, its likelihood of getting through Congress is nil. And then the second sentence right after that, he says, second of all, I think it would be very divisive. And then he goes on to explain that the real issue is when we look at the poverty rate among African-American communities, when we look at the high unemployment rate, he says we have a lot of work to do. And then he talks about what that would be. And Mr. Coates, I know, basically, questioned Mr. Sanders' understanding of it, and also said, well, why is it that you're, you know, willing to do things like make an effort, you know, a great effort to install or implement single-payer health care, but you suddenly become very pragmatic when it comes to reparations, because, and again, this goes back to Mr. Sanders' first reason he gave, which is its likelihood of getting through Congress is nil. And I was struck by the fact that for some reason, and maybe because of the forum or because of the amount of time left for questions, nobody asked Ms. Reed why she didn't mention the second reason, which was the divisiveness reason. And I understand that even that reason, you know, may not seem like it's enough. And I was very interested in Mr. Conright's comments, you know, about saying that in a sense, people in the African American community and other minority communities or other vulnerable communities feel that they should hold Mr. Sanders to a higher standard. And maybe that's true. And maybe that's right. And they wouldn't, in a sense, even try to hold.
Well, I'll be
to that standard.
Harry, yeah. If I may, I would like, you know, I think he was trying to answer that question as honestly as he could, without necessarily being as candid as he could, because in saying it's very divisive, what that really means, at least to me, knowing my history and as you know yours, what that really means to me is. And particularly that binary, it wouldn't go anywhere in Congress and it would be very divisive. That means this country is still way too racist to even be able to talk about it openly.
Yes, and I think you're right about that. But I think when he was talking about divisiveness, I think he was talking, well, and even Coates talks about that Coates is disappointed that Senator Sanders wants to basically attack, economic or wealth income inequality and other social justice issues, in a sense, as some, you know, it's basically a united movement or a united, effort. And I understand, you know, and I've read Mr. Coates' article several times, and, you know, I'm not going to say that there's nothing to what he's saying, but he does say at one point, why should black voters support a candidate who does not recognize this? This is about talking about Jim Crow and his legacy. He says, Jim Crow and his legacy were not merely problems of disproportionate poverty. And he's right.
No, it's a problem of overt racism, and... I think to a certain extent, he also, in a different article, addressed that, perhaps tangentially, but he said, I've spent the past 2 years in an article called Hillary Clinton Goes Back to the Dunning School. He said, I've spent the past two years somewhat concerned about the effects of national amnesia, largely because I believe that a problem cannot be effectively treated without being effectively diagnosed. I don't know how you diagnose the problem of racism in America without understanding its actual history. In the Democratic Party, there is, on the one hand, a candidate who seems comfortable doling out the kind of myths that undergirded racist violence, and on the other is a candidate who seems uncomfortable asking whether the history of racist violence in and of itself is worthy of confrontation. And he says these are options for a party of amnesiacs.
But see, I could be totally wrong about this, but how can a person, and I'm talking about Senator Sanders, be involved in the civil rights movement? And, you know, back when he was in college, how can anyone say that he doesn't really understand anything about it?
Oh, I don't think that's the argument at all, Harry. In this particular piece, Mr. Coates continues and says, this is not a brief for staying home because such a thing doesn't actually exist. In the American system of government, refusing to vote for the less than ideal is a vote for something much worse. Even when you don't choose, you choose. But you can choose with your skepticism fully intact. You can choose in full awareness of the insufficiency of your options without elevating those who would have us forget into prophets. You can choose and still push. So, from my white privilege standpoint, I don't think the article was particularly helpful, to the extent that it may have been picked up and advanced by the Hillary campaign. But the problem's real.
Oh, I think the problem is very real. And, you know, I see it here in Baltimore every single day. And as you know, or the listeners might know, You know, I pretty much take public transportation, which here in Baltimore, at least for me, is mostly buses. So, you know, I'm not in any way, frankly. And there are a lot of people, frankly, in Baltimore County, and I've had people tell me this, and say they would never take a bus in Baltimore City. So, and yes, I'm sure I'm from white privilege, you know, I'm Jewish, but I guess what I'm trying to say is, what I'm concerned about is that maybe that the divisiveness is, that word, in a sense, can be twisted so easily out of context that it does become, you know, a sword, a weapon against Mr. Sanders, Senator Sanders, in a way that is, you know, might be, that is, well, to me, it's regrettable. Because he may not have, you know, perfect credentials, and certainly, yes, he's white, and so he doesn't understand what it is to have skin that is not white. But it seems, you know, but in relative terms, I mean, in terms of any other candidates running for president, I guess I'm just not convinced that he, as Joanne Reed basically said this morning, she said she doesn't think he gets it. Well, I think he gets it. But as you said, it may be that in terms of the, you know, current political primary situation that he's in, you know, that this was at least the first answer that he thought he should give. And I'm not saying it should be the last answer.
No, and by the way, Isaac just tweeted me and said, yeah, please tell Harry that Joanne Reed supports Hillary and she has lied on Bernie Sanders with fake stories.
Oh, okay. Well, see, I didn't even know that. And this never came out, frankly, in this, at least the recording of the book talk, you know, at all. I mean, of course, Mr. Steiner, the moderator, I mean, he's much too polite to even, you know, have gone there, I suspect. And plus, I imagine, you know, that most of the audience, well, that a lot of the audience was African-American because of Ms. Reed's, you know, they had some admiration for her. And the other, and see, I'm combining this in a sense with the fact that I've been told, you know, here in Maryland that actually, a lot of older African Americans, and told this by someone of that from that group, are going to vote for Hillary Clinton and not for Bernie. And that although Bernie Sanders may do well with the very young black voters, that in fact, I mean, Mr. Conrad, I'm just thinking about Mr. Conrad talking about how the black community, the authority figures are politicians and heads of churches, and that's certainly true about Baltimore. And, you know, and the thing is, though, also, you know, actually, first of all, I understand that Mr. Sanders is coming here to Baltimore again, but, you know, he was here once, and he actually did not make it into a public event. He went to, I mean, in the sense of a, you know, big stage, whatever, you know, typical political event. He went directly to the Sandtown neighborhood, which is where Freddie Gray was from. And he met with at least, I know, one minister down there. And then escorted around, and he didn't stay long. But on the other hand, he didn't try to make it into, you know, oh, I'm Bernie Sanders and I'm coming to Baltimore, you know, and I'm gonna, you know, be your leader, make everything better. I mean, it was somewhat discreet, and I wouldn't be surprised if people in other parts of the country didn't know that he actually came to the exact neighborhood where Mr. Gray was arrested, and you know, after which he was put in the ambulance and ended up dying or being killed by the police, I guess.
Well, there's a certain amount of the electorate, Harry, for whom that doesn't matter. And I hate to say it that way, but it's true.
Yeah.
I don't know what the percentage is of potential Democratic voters who haven't made up their minds is. But I suspect it's fairly narrow. And the real, you know, the real answer to this question, given the size of the various groups, is who's going to turn out? If the millennials who support Bernie Sanders by such a broad majority, if they show up, it's over. If they don't, then the older Americans who are much more intent and intense about voting, well, if they outvote them, then it's Hillary. I mean, it seems like a pretty stark contrast. A couple of observations along the way from based on what you've been saying. Carol asks, do you know why the black community wants reparations? For the same reason people sue for damages, and this will speak to your background.
Sure.
It's the only way to seek relief from the people still harming you. We're talking about people who've waited 250 years for reforms, maybe even 400. How much longer do they have to be patient? And why won't and I think this is a significant question that sort of got sort of addressed yesterday in Charleston. Why won't anyone cold ask Hillary the same question that they cold asked Bernie? If someone asked me cold, I'd probably give a less than perfect or satisfactory answer myself.
Okay. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, I think the point is well taken that and it's just like, you know, why Black Lives Matter matters.
Went after Bernie in Seattle
and at Netroots Nation, Hillary didn't show up at Netroots Nation, but it took a while before they began to try to reach her. And, you know, given, and I know you know what these are too, given the rules of primacy and recency, maybe asking her those questions now, it turns out to be the strategic best approach.
Maybe. I think, you know, well, look, I think, frankly, probably everybody who's in the Horn community, I think, understands, you know, what the reparations are about. And certainly, you know,
it's odd that we persist in using the word reparations when you and I come from a place where, and several other members of the Horn community, Steve and Bilbo Rick come to mind, it's damages.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is one of those framing issues.
Well, maybe, except no, I mean, I always have thought of reparations as damages. I mean, the two words are very much related. I don't know. I myself don't see any, you know. I don't feel confused about that. I understand they were talking about, you know, damages for, you know, hundreds of years, and lots of harm of all kinds. What I'm, I guess, concerned about is just the general issue of even, let's say, on the side of the people who are in the end or have already decided to vote for Bernie Sanders. I don't know. Another reason I'm bringing this up is, first of all, because of what I'm hearing about Maryland and Baltimore and how that vote might go, which to me is very sad in terms of the older African-American population. I also regularly read a website, which is a strange combination of news stories and opinion posting called Democratic Underground. And I've been reading this website on and off for several years, and there's both Bernie Sanders supporters and Hillary Clinton supporters, although most people agree that it's probably about, in terms of people post regularly, probably about 5-1 in favor of Sanders. But there has been a great deal of venom and, all sorts of things being said. And people who have been on this particular website as long as the 2008 campaign have said that the level of, you know, of bile and vile and venom is much, much worse than in 2008. And people basically, you know, and from what I can see, yes, I mean, well, it's pretty sad. And there is a lot of many, many insulting things said, and certainly on both sides. And it's not just, you know, Hillary supporters, but also the Sanders supporters have said some very rude and, you know, very disrespectful things. And today there was a post, and this is not a particularly eloquent, I would say. I mean, it's nicely written. It's nothing poetic, but it's by a gentleman, and basically the title of the post is "Don't Ask Me to Give Up Sanders." And now maybe, you know, this is something that is more something I can relate to than other discussions, but he says, "I'm 63 years old, a lifelong Democrat. Of course, now I would be considered a progressive. It really doesn't matter what you call me. All I know is that I identify with the policies and practices of FDR." And before that, he talked about how sad it was that there was so much acrimony on this, what has always been basically a pretty progressive Democratic website, you know, in general, regardless of who you're supporting. And then he says, so along comes Bernie Sanders. You can call him a progressive, a socialist, a liberal, whatever. For me, he is what the Democratic Party used to be. He's unashamed of his political philosophy. He says, it isn't simply a matter of being consistent. It is a sign of someone who is genuine. That is rare in life and even rarer in politics. And I'm just reading portions of it. I want to just give you the flavor of it. And he says, and now I'm asked to abandon this rare and unique man who I've been waiting for the entirety of my life. I'm being asked to support Hillary, who in my mind represents the, quote, old school of politics. Now, he had earlier said that he doesn't feel that he hates Hillary and that he would vote for her if she were the nominee. It's just that he feels that she's from the older school of politics. And he says, I'm asked to support someone who seems to desire the presidency more for her own sake than for the sake of others. You want me to back someone who has colored the truth and employed tactics that I've long abhorred. Then he says, I don't hold any hatred for Hillary or her supporters. Those that back her are simply, well, this is what his opinion. He says, those that back her are simply not ready for a true Democrat. Change is hard. It is risky and causes anxiety in people that are not ready for it. And then he concludes by saying, I will not see another Bernie Sanders in my lifetime. This is my one shot at voting for someone and not against someone else. It is an opportunity to reverse at least some of the policies of the past three decades. It will not be easy, but nothing worth fighting for is easy. And he says, even if Bernie fails to get in the White House, I can at least say to myself that I saw a rare and unique politician occupying a rare and unique opportunity, someone who is not afraid, someone who puts people ahead of his own ego. And anyway, so I mean, those are the highlights.
And that, you know, I mean, that echoes my own feeling. I don't get. Yeah. I mean, God knows, here in West Virginia, I never get the opportunity to vote for somebody who even shares 80% of my values, 70, 60, because you can't run for office in the state of West Virginia without bowing down and getting the tip end of your nose all blacked up on coal.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. What do you think, since, you know, we have a slight disagreement about this, but what would be appropriate for Bernie Sanders to say that would we start to bring about some sort of reconciliation, you know, at this point with the part of the African American community who feels that he doesn't completely understand you know, reparations, doesn't completely understand the level or volume or amount or whatever of harm that has been done and over how many years or centuries it's been done. What could he do that would, you know, in a sense?
Well, I mean, I'm not indicting him for the answer, Harry, but.
Oh, no. I'm not asking it to you. What I'm saying is because I feel like this person is a 53-year-old, I'm so sensitive to the divisiveness at this point, you know, that even at this point, even within or possibly within, let's say, the Sanders circle, that I would be, you know, I wish I knew how Senator Sanders could basically.
I'm not in that position, and nobody who isn't can ever fully give an answer. But in situations such as that, Harry, a really if you have a gut level comprehension that elements of your own privilege are going to compromise your potential answer. You know, not so much that you're trying to give the right answer, but the question is, why don't you tell me your position? Tell me what you think the answer is. Tell me how I can get this right for you.
Well, yeah, no, that sounds, you know, like a very reasonable thing to do. I see. I guess I'm trying to say is that I think there's this binary kind of dynamic going on. And, you know, the fact is that Bernie Sanders, I mean, it's not like he's a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, you know, who went to prep school and, you know. Whatever.
No. But the word
from a working class background, he's Jewish, which still, at least in my opinion, and I'm a very secular Jew, is still problematic in this country. So I don't see him as being really at the pinnacle of white privilege at all. I don't even, I guess, even see him being close.
Well, I don't know that there's a pinnacle. It just is something that exists.
It exists. Yes, that I fully agree with.
And you know it is a bit of a Gordian knot.
Yeah,
as Mr. Coates has pointed out, there have, you know, you can codify a lot of civil rights legislation as reparative. You know, the Voting Rights Act is reparative. Fair housing standards are reparative. Attempts to eliminate redlining are reparative. Exposure and in where necessary, the prosecution of people who use the subterfuge of it's just business to enforce racist policies. That's reparative. Section 1983 civil rights cases are reparative. And so the question becomes, if I understand it correctly, well, it was, I hate to even use this phrase because it's so godforsaken loaded, Harry.
Oh yeah, everything we're talking about.
But when you use the word reparations, you have thrown a gotcha out because I'm not disagreeing with you. I think I'm trying to agree with you. There's no right answer. There is I'm going to get in trouble here. I don't think people of Anthony Conright's generation want 40 acres and a mule.
That's
an antiquated concept.
Right.
But that's how it's understood. What we need is a better understanding. And so I think the only answer is to say, please define the word. I mean, if I'm running for office and you step up and you say, Bob, what is your position on Blicknadaboo? Well, I don't know what that word means. What's your position on Jabberwock?
Right.
Well, my only alternative is to say, please define the word for me.
Right. And see, as I said, this is all coming out of Joanne Reed, who, you know, frankly, I myself have respected her work, but she seemed to be so certain herself, you know, about the answer. And that's, in a sense, what bothered me, and maybe it's because it's.
Well, I think you were.
That she is a Hillary partisan. Maybe that's why. But I think maybe that's what you were tapping into. Well, yes, but you see, this was, you know, I mean, this was from what I could hear of the audience. This was, I mean, this was a mixed bunch. In fact, there was one member of the city council there, even because she introduced herself. So, you know, and this was so I can imagine that this was a very mixed group of people. Particularly in a city like Baltimore, you know, with the demographics that we have. And so, and yet it seemed to come down, you know, so, in a sense, so with so much certainty on that one side, you know, about this, whatever you want to call it, reparations, you know, payment for, you know, debt for damages for, you know, centuries of harm. That's what bothered me. You see, and I felt that I just, and you see, what surprised me was that she didn't, in a sense, go over, in a sense, all, even if Mr. Sanders' original answer was not, let's say, the clearest, or, you know, or could have said something even more, but she didn't even, she just talked about the first sentence. And I think that was, you know, and all that, I think all that does is, again, in a sense, if anything, you know, make people bring up more acrimony, bring up more, you know, disagreements.
Because I get it. Because the headline the next day then is Bernie Sanders evades question of, and I mean,
Well, it's
8:40. It's 8:41, so we can have our obligatory Star Trek reference. It's a Kobayashi Maru. It's a no win situation. It's a no win situation.
Well, no win. Yeah. Well.
So
well, it may be.
But my feeling
about no win situations is that they're not healthy for anybody, because, you know, and there's something even more serious beyond, you know, no win, which is, you know, what psychologists call a double bind.
Yeah.
Where in fact, part of the problem there is that you're not allowed to talk about the fact that it's a no win situation.
Right. And in the context of the Star Trek universe, Harry, you know, the whole purpose of the Kobayashi Maru exercise was not to find out if you could win, but to find out what kind of command character you had.
Right.
But it was a character test, not a strategy test.
Yeah, well, I don't even know how to judge that, because, you know, I mean, as I recall, if I can recall correctly, Captain Kirk, in a sense, bent the rules.
No, he cheated.
Okay, I'm being polite. Yeah, no, he cheated. Right. So, you know, what does that say then? You know, do we commend him for going outside, you know, the rule of outside the box?
Well, that's what they did.
Or do we say, right, but.
But to go back, I have an example here. Isaac provided it to me.
Yeah. Okay.
I've got a link here, and there's no text. It's a video. And you know, to a certain extent, that's regrettable. But it's a tweet. Joy Ann Reid defends Hillary Clinton's white privilege, troubling and disappointing.
Hey, is this a real tweet?
Yeah, this is a real tweet.
Oh, my. I don't think she did that either.
And one of the people tweeting on the comments said...
She certainly didn't do that.
...said, I was done with her the moment I heard her speech to vote in favor of invading Iraq, also disappointed in her dishonest claim to be unbiased.
This is about Hillary Clinton.
No, I think the last one is claimed to be unbiased. I think that's about Joy Ann Reid.
Is that about Joy Ann Reid? Oh, yeah. About Joy Ann Reid?
It was tweeted by at Sally Hampton. If you want to go and look for it.
No, I believe it. I believe it. I'm just saying, see, that to me is even sadder. I mean, because, you know, then I would say, well, thanks so much, Joy Ann Reid, you know. I mean,
well, and see, that's the thing, that's the problem here, Harry.
No, it's sarcastic, obviously.
No, I know, but that's the problem. You've got people hiding out under the rubric, or not rubric, but hiding behind the skirts of so-called unbiased journalism, who are anything but. I mean, yeah. like that thing I mentioned a couple of nights ago, from Yamiche Alcindor, that went to great pains to describe how Bernie just wasn't resonating with the black people, with the old black people at church eating fried chicken collards and fresh baked rolls.
I remember that.
And yeah. and that's just one of those little things I notice, and I go, because there's a dog whistle in there. Or take this business about of what I read either last night or this morning about how Bernie isn't embracing his Jewishness enough. And yeah, you chuckle. And I mean,
I chuckle because, in fact, he's always called himself basically a secular Jew, and pretty much has never really.
The New York Times went out to find Jewish people who would tell him that Bernie isn't really Jewish. So they found one guy who said he referred to himself as the son of a Polish immigrant, and he said, "Why didn't he say Polish Jew?" Because, you know, back in Poland, they wouldn't have considered him Polish. And then they found the other guy, like I mentioned before, who said, "Well, you know, I mean, when Joe Lieberman was a real Jew, and I mean that was important when he got nominated for the vice presidency." And you know, and my little comment on it to whoever posted it was, next up, a searing expose on Bernie Sanders, why he uses loop, swoop, and pull to tie his shoelaces instead of bunny ears. Because that's where gotten.
Right, and I guess I'm saying, like, with the Jewish thing, for even that, let's say, it becomes a, in a sense, not reasonable binary question. Because it's not about whether you're Jewish or not. I mean, there's no, you know, just bright line, you know, either zero or one. You're not, you know, that's not what even being Jewish is about, or any religion.
Right, and my thought on it was, well, that's okay. Give Bill a minute. He'll make sure everybody in South Carolina knows Bernie Sanders is a Jew. And he'll make sure that everybody in Mississippi and Alabama and Tennessee and Georgia and Louisiana and Oklahoma, they'll make sure. If Bernie won't embrace his Jewishness, they'll do it for him.
Well, I guess maybe underneath that's what's so sad to me is the fact that we come to this place where every dispute is binary and, you know, no nuance and, you know, you're, you know, either on the polar, you know, one side of the polarity or the other, and no even question about, you know, I don't know, something nested inside in another nest is still, that becomes binary when in fact, you know, really nothing in the world is black or white. I mean,
Hey, Harry, yeah. I do have a couple. I've got at least one person who wants to chime in on this issue. You've raised it, and that does what is supposed to happen here. You have created conversational space, and I appreciate it. And I don't know, maybe you'll jump in on Friday on the front porch tomorrow.
Well, thank you very much, but thank you for taking the time to talk.
It's always a pleasure, Harry. Always a pleasure.
Oh, well, you're very kind. Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. Bye now. Our buddy Harry in Baltimore. Let's see. Yeah, $400 to raise in 12 minutes. Hey, we could do that, couldn't we? But thank you very kindly, Diane in Kansas Stand, for being there this evening. It is much appreciated. Specifically, Tracy had said that she wanted to had something to offer in this light. So I'm going to sit here and wait and see if she fires up the Skype. So Ron up in the frozen north says, To the untrained eye, Bernie has been far more active on the ground with respect to civil rights than Hillary. I'm having trouble getting my head around why Hillary is regarded as being more in tune with the black community than Bernie, and I got no answer either. And along the way, it's 11 minutes before the hour, but while we've been talking about these issues, horror has been unfolding in Kansas. Well, I mean, you can call it horror or Thursday. There are four people dead, and as many as 20 injured in Heston, H-E-S-S-T-O-N, Kansas. It's about 130 miles from Topeka. A man with an AK-47 and apparently lots of bullets walked onto the grounds of the Excel plant, a lawnmower manufacturer, and began shooting. He was a former Excel employee. He shot and killed an elderly woman in the company's parking lot before he headed into the building and kept on shooting. Authorities in Harvey County, Kansas, have confirmed that the previously lawful gun owner, who only with the squeeze of a trigger became an awful gun owner, is now dead. 20 to 30 people were injured in the attack. KAKE TV has the coverage. Uncertain. The death toll has grown to between 4 and 7 people. The lawful gun owner's name is was Cedric Ford. He had been a painter for Excel. He was shot and killed by authorities because Merca, the greatest country in the world on earth, now, today, forever in the universe. God bless America. And God we trust. Amen. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, sweetie. I closed out the show. I was listening to Harry, and I can understand. I really enjoyed the young man that you had on, because he's only a couple of years older than my millennial child. And I actually have a millennial who's going to be voting for Bernie Sanders and his mom. Again, like you said, I will be voting for Bernie Sanders. And if, for no other reason other than the fact that, like you said, just, you know, we may not ever have this chance again. And as far as reparations are concerned, the thing about reparations is that it will, like you said, this country is so racist. We can't even get people convicted or even indicted for crimes against black people. Okay? So do you really think we're going to be able to, at this point in time, going to even get people to think about giving us any kind of, you know, rewarding us damages?
No, but by the same token, one of those answers, you know, Bernie's given it. He says that every time there is a, every time there is a police killing, there needs to be an independent review of it.
Yes.
Well, you know what? You can file that under repair under reparative conduct.
Exactly.
But see, this the code, the and this is largely white folks' code. But
I know, like mine.
But I know black people understand it when they hear it. See, white people hear reparations and they think somebody's going to get a check for being black.
Mm-hmm.
Which, yep, by the way, I'm okay with.
I am too.
And I will immediately send in my $250 to Ancestry.com to get my genotype run. And I'm gonna find him. No, I'm kidding.
No, but see, here's the thing. Have you ever heard of Dr. Joy DeGruy? She wrote a book called Post-Traumatic Slave Disorder. And one of the things she writes about or talks about, because she does, I'm going to see if I can find a link to one of her. Actually, I think I put it in Dropbox. I think I just sent you that link to that. One of, in her talks, because she talks around the country, she says, as far as reparations are concerned, one of the first things that the government should do is give every Black person in America the money, or not even just to pay for DNA, to pay for DNA testing. So we can at least know where we came from.
Yeah. I mean, I, just as an academic academic undertaking, I would love to know just who all.
Mm-hmm.
And I, yeah, I like who all's back there?
Yeah, is there a Negro in the woodpile? I said it.
Well, no, I mean, it wouldn't bother me in the least.
I know, but I love for the white people who will, who, like I said, you know, I think we talked, have we ever talked about, you know, about people who pass? And there was a brother that I just read a book about, a story about him, how it was like that open secret that everybody knew he was Black, but nobody said anything. He was a, I don't know if he was a book editor for the Times or something. And we talked about knowing your truth. And, you know, everybody was waiting for him to write this great novel because he was an amazing writer. But the problem is, you can't write about who you are if your whole life is a lie. So you can't write it. You know, there's that. So you, and it won't ring true. If you're writing your story and you leave out the part where I've been passing as a white man all my, you know, all my, my entire adult life. And I've said it out loud because when they, when he passed away, his daughter found, she's like, oh my God, so I'm Black. Half Black, yeah, you're Black. That one drop rule. But as far as, did you ever read Ta-Nehisi Coates' article in The Atlantic on the case for reparations?
Yes.
Amazing. And it's not even, he doesn't even, you know, because he, his thesis is, it's not about the slavery. Okay, I can hear y'all screaming, okay, slavery so long ago. And, you know, that happened. Okay, get over it.
Yeah, but the ripples are still crossing the pond.
Oh, yeah, of course. The ripple is still crossing the pond. But what I love about his story, was his article, was the fact that he brought it up to just the redlining and the denial of Black people being able to get decent, you know, getting into housing and education, and how they were ripped off for, you know, easy credit ripoffs, these, you know, people paying all this money for houses that weren't. So, you know, and this is recent. You know, this the racism, like you said, is systemic. And until we have these uncomfortable conversations, it will never change. I mean, it's not uncomfortable for me. I'm cool with it because I know what's going on. It's when white people start saying, we need to have a conversation. Because, again, I could jump up and down until I'm blue in the face. Well, you know.
Yeah, and see, what, and you're identifying the I mean, I think you're in line in many ways with what Harry was saying and what I'm saying, in that there's no right answer to that question.
No.
Because no, you could, I mean, you can make people's eyes roll back in their head and fall asleep when you start saying things like, well, for starters, I think we could look at discriminatory practices, and we could make it a federal law instead of individual states, saying that anybody caught doing that will be strictly liable in tort for the for treble damages,
or treble.
And you know what? Before you get from strict to liable to tort, everybody else is going, oh, what the fuck is this?
What the heck? Exactly. What are they? What are you talking about? And so until you, we have a lot of work to do in this country. But until the powers that be start to work. Again, I mean, I have Black Lives Matters, Occupy Wall Street, all these groups, these grassroots groups that are screaming and hollering at the top of their lungs, and people are poo-pooing them like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Until the people, the powers that be, stop poo-pooing them and stop being condescending and start listening, and not only listening, but taking action. Did you watch Blackish?
No TV.
No TV. Okay, well, I think you can watch it online.
Okay.
But last night's episode was about, you know, this is an upper middle class black family, and you know they had a fictional account of in a police brutality case, and to watch the reactions of these young kids, these millennials and younger, who were like, we're black, and realizing that, you know, it doesn't matter how much money you have in this country if you're black. And if you get a chance to watch it, if I can find it and send you the link to it, hell, I'll just give you my Hulu account number. You can just watch it on the computer. That, as a matter of fact, that's what I'll just do. Just so you can watch it.
Okay, and that having been said, we've rolled up onto the top of the hour, and I got to get out of here. Now that Malloy starts at the top of the hour, I got to get out at the top of
you
the
gotta
hour.
You got to get out. But anyhow, we'll talk tomorrow Friday on the front porch. I will be more than likely working and talking, and we'll talk. Because I definitely want to talk more about what we were talking about tonight. So anyway, good night, and we will talk tomorrow.
All right. Thanks so much. Take care, Tracy. Bye now.
You too. Bye-bye.
Wonderful night across the board. Really got to get out of here. Thank you, everyone. Hopefully we will not have a $600 fundraising goal by tomorrow evening. Really hope. But thanks, everyone. Have a wonderful evening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Good night, y'all.